Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Def Leppard there, and Rocket. Because hopefully the whole thing's getting a bit of a rocket under it, maybe several rockets, and I suspect that some of those are probably going to have to come from us. We're kicked off there with If I Could Only Flag Her Down by ZZ Top. That one's going out for Hillary, because I think she has been flagged down. Hopefully she will get flagged down further. Well, that's my hope anyway. And that was followed by Brian Lewis and his brave tune, I Think My Dog's a Democrat. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com and autonomousmedia.net. Pretty shortly, I think sometimes toward the end of this month, we will no longer be broadcasting from where we are, and you'll all have to wander across to autonomousmedia.net and see what it's like over there. I'm really excited this evening because Stella Berg's making a return to Dr. Rock's radio show to have another chat with us. Hi there, Stella.
Hello, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. Hopefully everybody can hear you out there. I'm sure they'll let me know if they can't. Thanks for coming back and rejoining us. We're looking to have a bit of a discussion about fear because it's so widespread, and about illusion because a lot of the fear, I think, is arising because people are believing things to be true that basically aren't. Do you think that's a fair thought?
I think it's not only a fair thought, and I think it's been programmed into us from childhood. And ever see a film called What the Bleep Do We Know?
I certainly did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're getting so many receptors built for fear, terror, anxiety, stress, panic, that it's actually almost revolutionary to become peaceful and cheerful and optimistic. And I think it's the training starts in early childhood, because you don't think of Tom and Jerry being actually, you know, a violent mouse and an aggressive cat. But it's all part of the general lack of love and care and attention that it's just pushed on children the minute they get out of nursery, basically. And sometimes it's beginning even to get there a bit before that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they certainly do seem to be even trying to get to they seem to be trying to get to women before the babies are even born now. On one of the points you made there, this thing about being comfortable and that it practically being a revolutionary act in itself. One of the things that I've been wondering about is how it is that so many people like us can know so much about what's going on in the world and still be comfortable and cheerful and happy with the way it's going. I mean, it's a blessing, obviously, and I'm amazed, frankly, that, you know, each day we find out something that's just a little bit more horrendous than yesterday. And yet we, you know, we keep on keeping on. It's a kind of miracle in itself, I think.
It is, but also I think it's part of it is the empowerment. While you're denying stuff, and it's in your unconscious, or at least at the back of your mind, I think it's the dislocated paradigm. There's two things going on in your mind, two realities. I can't remember the term they use for it at the moment.
Cognitive dissonance.
That's the one. So once you've acknowledged what's going on, I think you have the freedom of having your horrified reactions. And you can be confident because you believe, at least rightly or wrongly, that you have some clear hold on what's going on. And that is actually less stressful than having to live with knowing one thing and not accepting it.
Yes, and I think it's great, isn't it, to feel that we can actually respond, that rather than just being patronised and mistreated, that suddenly there's at least the opportunity for maybe doing something about it, because I think there's a tendency to discover what's going on pretty much at the same time as discovering there's things that one can do about it.
But yeah, I think so. Although with a lot of people, there is a great hiatus between seeing what's going on and feeling at all empowered about it. You're right, the first reaction is anxiety, isn't it, quite often? But then you learn what's going on very often off people who are doing something about it. So you come into this new state where you know what's wrong with society or some bits of it, but you see people being active in talking and resisting, I suppose. So, and do you know, I one of the things that constantly amazes me is the great gush of energy that does arrive when people go click and they can acknowledge something's happening. I've seen that so many times, and it's kind of like, whew, I can just stop pretending everything's all right.
That's a funny thing, that stop pretending everything's all right, because I don't think I've mentioned to you the Dark Mountain Press, who are some people that I met recently. And at the very beginning, somebody wrote a manifesto of about 20 pages. If you look up Dark Mountain Manifesto, you can find it. It's an inspired piece of writing, and all it was doing, it was suggesting that we look at the darker sides, the shadow side of what we're doing here. And and it went down really well. It got reviewed by the New York Review of Books, who gave it several stars and said that actually it was a pamphlet that was more likely to cause cultural change than anything they'd seen in a decade or more, which was, you know, I mean, that's pretty good. But what happened next was that there was kind of like a load of trolling in the press, because this isn't an internet thing, it's a physical thing. And they were called collapsitarians, they were called catastrophists, they were called psychotics, who were incapable of maintaining a sense of perspective and balance. And, I mean, just reading about that makes you think, oh, well, they really hit a nerve. And their response was to start publishing a literary journal, inviting people to put in photographs and pictures of sculpture and poetry and prose and all that, that basically were attempts to look at the shadow side of what's going on and at least get our artists to start thinking and imagining about what we might actually do about it. And they've now published 10 hardback volumes in 5 years, held 4 festivals and released 3 CDs.
Wow.
So but what's really interesting, to go back to the point I was actually trying to make, is that there was such a massive response against people who were just recommending talking about it.
Well, it's interesting. I think there's 2 levels to the shadow concept, because every time I watch standard films or go to a gym and watch the horrible movies that they put on, it's all black and dark and violent and horrible and scary. And if you follow Jung, the shadow side of that is actually loving kindness. And I think about things like when do you remember when the full Monty was produced? Such a low budget film, so feel good, and it went stratospheric.
Mm.
Because I think that is now the shadow side as well.
Yeah. Yes, it's basically become so kind of, what's the word? It's lost most of its power, so that the shadow is now the non-shadow.
Well, yeah. I mean, we live in a horrible world. It's probably, I when I was thinking about what we might talk about this evening, I was thinking about Hobbes. You know, there were 2 or 3 philosophers around in the 18th century who were very important to how we think today. And we could touch on Descartes if you're interested. But Hobbes was the one who said life was nasty, mean, brutish and short. And, you know, if you go round the average graveyard of an old church, it's not true. This is what I mean by first-hand experience. The average age of death might have been about 45, but that accounted for kids under 5, disease, women in childbirth, men going off to war and falling under ploughs and stuff like that. And if you got through those, then you're quite likely to live till you were 75 or 80, but in good health.
And that's certainly certainly my experience of old graveyards, is that there seemed to be quite a lot of people that were living to 70, 80 and 90.
Exactly. So life wasn't nasty, mean, brutish and sort. And, you know, if you think about the average business, for example, if you were living on some landlord's property, yeah, you had to work for them. But the system wouldn't work if all the bosses were all cruel. I think a lot of them probably had very good relationships with their serfs.
I suppose there must have been good and bad, just like there's good and bad employers. I mean, my experience of the world has not been... I mean, obviously, I'm pretty lucky being born in a wealthy part of the world, but that just determines the kind of advantage that I've got. To me, life hasn't been, and the time on this blue ball hasn't been brutish at all. In fact, it has been and continues to be just the most miraculous education, really. And somehow, even when I do make decisions for which I should, maybe take a bit of a beating, somehow I seem to be cradled through the whole thing. And the older I get, the more I look back at what's happened and think, blimey, that was really lucky, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, I think it always has been. My son says this to me. He says, we are living in a horrible time. Don't wait for it to happen. It's already here. And if you take the view that the history books have all been written by the people who are running things, they want us to think everything is better and better. But, you know, someone who's a bit passionate about history, I start picking it apart and thinking, actually, you know, 100 saints' days a year, of which you had about a half off, that wasn't bad.
Yes, I gather that's why Merry England was called Merry England, was because we spent like half of the year celebrating or preparing to celebrate something. And it does strike me that nowadays we don't, as a people, celebrate anything together, really.
No. Even when I was growing up, there were processions along the streets, you know, the scouts and veterans and, you know, lots of public celebrations. And they've all disappeared, haven't they?
Mm. Also, Patrick's put a good point in the chat box. He said, if you remember back in the 70s, the news may have been bad now and again, but you'd get the good story of the cat being rescued out the tree. Do you remember that? The "and finally" story.
The last comment.
And now he says, now it's all war, war, war and fear, 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 which is certainly what I see when I only catch televisions when I'm in pubs and they're on, but it seems to be pretty bloody relentless.
Well, that's what I'm trying to put together, because I think on the one hand we've got this horrible news. On the other hand, we're being told this is the best time ever. In medieval times, everybody was having a miserable, trudgy, wooden, you know, muddy life with no food. I don't think it's true. I think we are living in one of the worst times. We have the least educated people, perhaps, because there was community wisdom, there was community knowledge. And I think universal literacy has actually made us all stupid, because what has gone with it is believe everything you read.
Yes, and as I say, worse than believing everything you read, if you don't read it, it's not true.
Yes, that's right. If you think it for yourself, it's not authentic. So it's, you know, I think that the whole sense of, I mean, remember the English eccentrics? It was perfectly all right to have your own ideas and your own character and behave in the way that seemed best for you. That's almost wiped out now.
Mm. And that's where the scientists would have come from as well. They would have been the slightly left-field natural philosophers trying to investigate their thoughts. And now it seems to me that philosophy and science have become largely separate.
Yes. Yes, physics and metaphysics have never been so far away.
Which is really weird, because, of course, physics has discovered that metaphysics is broadly right. It's also upside down. And this is one of the reasons why I thought this conversation would be an interesting one to have, is because everything is really back to front, and because it's all really fractal. It is kind of illusion upon illusion upon illusion. And really, the fear so much arises from, I don't know, the uniform somebody might wear, or just the way they knock on your door or something like that. None of which is actually real. It's all an expression of an authority which is being run entirely on a presumption. And the problem is that we seem to presume that it's right.
I think this thing about presumptions is very interesting, because I was pondering the connection between this virtual reality and common law. Because, you know, in common law, you cannot give evidence that is hearsay.
Yeah.
You can only discuss what you have seen and touched and smelt and tasted yourself. And I think that there is something very important in that connection, because we are being encouraged more and more, children, not to know the earth or people, except approved people. They're not encouraged to get first-hand experience of anything except computers, really. And yet, the reality, the going out into woods, the meeting strange people and having chats with the old man at the end of the road, that is actually what builds your capacity to experience directly and to think about your experience and digest it. And that's going.
Yes, I don't think you can really sort... Well, my experience has been that my best understanding of what I think, what I think I know, has come from talking to other people and has encouraged me to talk to more people. And really, it's... talking to others for me is a primary part of how I define myself, or how I find out what I actually am.
Yes, I agree with that. I wrote an article for one of my journals a while back about can I rant about homeopathy a tiny bit?
Oh, please do. Yeah, we're happy with homeopathic rants. That's all right here.
Good. Well, homeopathy is predicated on different personality types, which we call constitutions. So you have the stiff upper lipper and honourable, and you have the intellectual and a little bit nervous and anxiety-ridden, or the short and stubby and laid-back and very kindly person. You know, all these different personalities belong to remedy types for us. And I was remember watching a film where Michael Kitchen was the villain. And Michael Kitchen, for anyone who knows him, was, what was his name? He did a wartime film, didn't he? Can you remember what it was called?
Not me, no. This is all a bit of a mystery to me. I find that I've got a poor memory for films and actors and stuff. That's why my willing suspension of disbelief is so good.
Right. Maybe someone in the chat box will know. Oh. Anyway, he always plays straight up, absolutely honourable, tight-lipped, hiding his griefs bravely, sort of English personality. And it works because that's who he is, right? That's his natural constitution. But in this film, he was a villain. He was playing not an atmeo, which he is, but a lycopodium, which he isn't. And I suddenly thought, children who are not being allowed to get to know people, parishioners in their local church, people up and down their road, the keeper of the local shop, all they're getting is synthetic television characters and people playing different constitutions. And so instead of growing up saying to each other, oh, you don't want to know, go near that man, he's a bit like the postman was. Do you remember the postman? You didn't want to go up an alley with him. And I think children used to learn basic personality types and who to trust and who not from just meeting the members of their community. And they're, of course, kept away from it now. They're just given television personalities.
Mm. Do you think political correctness also works in that direction? Because I have a tendency to think that if there's a load of stuff we're not allowed to say because it gets us into trouble, that prevents certain signals reaching society that might be useful for society to have.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's all reducing our self-expression, isn't it? And it makes people inauthentic.
Yeah, and that makes him... do you think that makes it any easier to spot the authentic ones?
Yes. Yes, I think the astonishing thing is, by and large, when you meet somebody who is being themselves, it's quite shocking. And a little offensive sometimes, because it's a bit raw.
Yeah.
It's a bit like realising that piece of steak you ate came from a real cow.
This is, if you like, a little bit of a dip into where we want to go in the second half of the show with what exactly we do all of it with all of this stuff. And actually, you've just touched, as you do a lot when we're chatting, it has to be said, on something which I think's been a core recognition of mine, is that I used to be a different individual. Even when I was a small lad, it was noticed that I spoke proper Leicester with the common language and all of that when I was at school. But when I was with my parents, I spoke received English. So I was kind of like two entities, as it were. And as I got older, I became several. I was one person at home. I was a different individual when I was at work, or dealing with authority or whatever. And it's just kind of slip into these various cloaks or whatever. Whereas now, I think one of the main differences between the me that was and the me that's doing this radio show is that I am now pretty much what I am wherever I go. One or two people get honourable exceptions because they just get so, so upset that it's just not worth it. But by and large, I am who I am wherever I go. And I think that's got to be, do you think that's one of the things we're maybe aiming to discover and enact?
Yes, I do. And something I've observed, which is, I'm just trying to make the connection mentally. When you see a child that you haven't met for months or years, it's very interesting because they immediately go back into the stage they were when they last met you. Because that's who they were when they related to you last. And I have a feeling that that is a characteristic that the Edward Bernayses and the psychologists who are trying to mess us up are making full use of, because it's a way of infantilizing people.
God, yeah, I do remember reading that the basic thing is if you want to sell something to somebody, treat them like an eight-year-old.
Yes.
Which explains the Omo adverts, if nothing else.
And the Oxo gravy ones.
That's right. Don't know whether you've still got quality adverts like that, folks, but even as a youngster, I used to look at those adverts and think, how in God's name can these things be selling anything to anybody?
You know what else, though? As I've got a grandson, I look through lots of children's books. There are no children's books that show IKEA-type homes. They are all traditional, rather wooden homes that look homely. You can't sell modern homes to children. They're not nice places.
That's interesting, because some friends of mine recently tried to become foster carers because all of their children have moved on and they're a lovely family. They get on really well with their kids. Everything's really great. And they had to go through a whole year of interviews at work, interviews at home. They had to have advanced, police checks, and they had to have medicals. These people kept coming around the house, which is basically attached to a farm buildings and stuff. And this whole thing was dragged out for like 16 months before eventually this sort of senior woman turned up and said, well, frankly, you don't stand a chance because of this, this and this. And I could go on. And apparently they're not allowed to tell you that they're turning you down. They're just positioning the candidates to a place where they just don't want to go on anymore. And these people thus didn't become foster carers. Neither did any of the eight couples that applied at the same time as they did. And this was basically because their house was not like the brick house that you describe with the central heating. They didn't like the wood burner. They didn't like all the Doctor Who toys. They didn't like screwdrivers lying around. They didn't like the fact that the windows were unlockable and people could get out of them. It would have been impossible for these people, who would, in my opinion, have made really great foster parents, to actually get children into that house. They wanted something that was completely not like the storybook house.
Yeah, but you see, if you put children in a house like that, they might grow happy and they might start thinking for themselves. That isn't what the establishment wants. One of my standards is to understand that we destroy in children the very qualities that we ought to admire in the grown-up.
Yeah. I think that's part of the core of the illusion, as is that example that I've just given, actually, of that couple that were applying to be foster carers. Our impression might well be that that one of the reasons we're handing over our council tax is so that our council can actually do something with disadvantaged children. And our impression might be that that's what the foster care service is. But if, as and when, we come to either experience it as an individual personally, firsthand, as you said, not hearsay, or through people that we know and trust, we discover, lo and behold, that it's just not that, it's something else.
Well, I think the whole... I was rereading Ivan Illich last week. You know, De-schooling Society is a bit old-fashioned now. But he has such insights. They hit you like bricks one after another. And he was talking then I think it was the 70s he was writing, about how more and more, instead of looking after your own children, you farm them out to professionals. Instead of looking after your own health, you farm it out to doctors. You know, at every point, instead of seeking your own justice and negotiating with your neighbour, you seek out policemen or they seek you out. At every point, we're being put in the hands of professionals as if we can't do anything ourselves. And so and parents who are being authoritative and competent are not welcome because they haven't got a degree in competence and authoritativeness.
Mm.
So they're not allowed to be like that. They should be asking the advice of people half their age, probably, who've been through a college course.
And I guess part of this, it strikes me, is that it seems to me that one of the reasons why children are there is so that the older generation can continue to learn and from the children, from the offspring, and that, again, seems to be a link that's being severed.
Yes, I think it's been severed, and I don't have a television, but I'm told that if you watch television regularly, there are almost no programmes on where elders are respected or treated with politeness. They're always disparaged and insulted and treated as doddery old fools and stuff like that. And it goes another step towards breaking the link between the parents and the grandparents and the children.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing you see that I don't see in my life out amongst the festivals and also amongst the various communities that I'm working with. I actually see quite a lot of respect on the ground for elders and for experience as well. You know, recognition on the ground, that's what I see going on. So
so do I. But it's not what's portrayed.
Mm-mm.
On the ground, on the hoof, I find that youngsters, you know, I'm a granny now, so I meet all these youngsters in their 20s, and they come to my house and they want to learn and they want to bask in the, how can you be so comfortable with life and sure about these things and you know so much, and it's restful for them to spend time with someone who's done a lot of the battling that they agonise about. And I'm treated as a trusted elder a lot of the time. And I didn't know that happened anymore. It's been a really pleasant surprise.
Yes, the same thing. The same thing's happening to a great extent to me and Synchro. It has to be said. We feel that despite the fact that we have no children or grandchildren, we're kind of becoming grandparents, and yes. We're treated like we've got some kind of authority, which I find really, really chuckle-worthy.
Well, the world is in need of them. You know, I remember one of my patients that I'd known since she was a little girl. She rang me up one day in terrible distress. She'd just done a course in medicine, and she'd come out with a, you know, class A degree, and she rang me up because she said, I don't know what to do. I'm qualified now, but actually what I want to do is I want to go and live with my mother and be a jewellery maker like she is, and I'm such an outcast, you know, I'm so weird. And we had this really long conversation for a couple of hours where I was trying to explain that all through history, people have taken up the tasks that their parents did. They've lived in the house that they grew up in, and instead of having to start a new life from scratch in their 20s, they could just carry on with an extended family and have all that support and all that help. And that link is being severed. So instead of, you know, Macbeth and Son family butchers, you don't have that. You know, they're severing all those inherited ties.
And that kind of removes a key part of our wealth as well, I think, because if you can actually kind of stay in the house that your parents and their parents grew up in with the sheds and the contents of the sheds and whatever tools and stuff you've got, obviously you're off to a roaring start. Having to start from scratch every time is a completely different thing. And because all of the wealth comes from the earth, not having a place on the earth where you can stay is a critical disadvantage to us.
Yes. And if a family stays together, then the accumulated wealth is stable, isn't it? I once met a woman in her 90s who lived in a house that her father had built. And it was amazing to be there because everything was in the right place. They tried all the wrong places.
Yeah.
They just got all the right places. And it felt, it wasn't a particularly interesting house, but everything felt right. And, you know, everybody must have grown up with that once upon a time.
I think there's something else there as well, in that in that then you can improve on the work of generations. I was talking a couple of weeks back about the fact that we've now been using the same apple press and pasteurizers for 10 years or so. And every year we learn something new. And that's because we're used to the tackle, we're used to the place that we're doing it. And I'm sure that much bigger advantage would have been gained, you know, had I been able to just sort of take over my dad's woodworking shop or something like that. But it's that the, it seems to me that the very thing somehow that kept families together is actively driving people apart, driving them to distant cities or, you know, distant countries or whatever. It's just kind of dissolved. It's such a subtle and all-enveloping process. It's really quite difficult to put your finger in any detail on how it's being done.
Well, I have a theoretical construct, if you're interested.
Oh, yeah, I'm interested.
This is going into homeopathic theory, and we have a theory of the families of disease, right? And that the first one, the deepest one, is called psora, which is skin diseases. But what it is actually is it's about small children and old people love patterns. They love sameness. They love the same thing every year, every week, every day. They like tradition. They like familiarity. And as you get older, you know, like teenagers want to go away and travel the world and have adventures and stuff. But little people and old people don't. So, you know, little boy goes to his grandmother's house every Sunday. He loves having the same thing to eat. He loves playing the same games. He likes the security of it. And that's called soric, and it's the traditionalist. And I think everybody who is traditionalist is being rocked to their cores because the traditional bit is the centre of people. So when they changed, for example, West Riding of Yorkshire to West Yorkshire, I personally took it as an insult because it's a familiar peculiarity that I loved. And when words are taken away and when, you know, boundaries are moved, they're all part of destabilising that sense of tradition. You yes. can't go to a carol service anymore and recognise a single carol that you grew up with. All of that stability is being taken away systematically. And did you ever read Alvin Toffler's Third Wave, or Shockwave it was called, I think?
No, I didn't.
It was about the pace of change, accelerating and accelerating, and how people are suffering from traumatic stress disorder because nothing remains the same long enough to anchor you in this reality. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely go along with that because I see the damage it does when people move, for example, when their children are around, you know, between 4 and 10. The child loses a great deal of its stability because its home and its environment have moved. And it has to learn a whole new set. It's really bad for people to keep moving.
I wonder whether this is why horticulture turns out to be such a good way of grounding even the most distressed of people because, you know, horticulture hasn't changed necessarily. I mean, we've been using Lawrence's Lawrence Hill's organic yeah. gardening book from the 40s, I think, this year. And it's certainly one of my main equalizers is in between doing this work, I spend my time with my hands in the soil. And perhaps that's literally anchoring us with the things that our ancestors have been doing.
I think you've got a really good point there. It's timeless, isn't it? Always has been, always will be. Things grow in certain ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think people are longing for familiarity. And at every point, it's being quite cruelly and deliberately taken away.
We can get it back, though, can't we? Just by starting to treat each other like human beings again.
Yes. But, you know, things like carols. I'm always sad that this generation... I'm not a Christian. You know, I used to get dragged onto school carol services and stuff like that as a child. But I love them. You know, they were a part of Christmas and you can't find them very easily anymore. But when you can find them, you find it's a lot of older people who just love the same old thing every year. What am I trying to say here? I think more and more we're going to find people going back and seeking the books that they grew up with as children and rebuying them. And you know, wearing old-fashioned shoes or clothes or just finding symbols that help to replace that.
I think that the drive to do that is certainly going to be it's going to be improved by the fact that the alternative is becoming so obviously completely unacceptable.
Yes. Yes, I mean, we used to build nice, if rickety and peculiar houses. Now we just have identikit boxes.
And they're well rickety, believe me. I've seen a fair few of them going up, and I don't think they're going to last.
Aren't they the ones that have a 10-year guarantee?
Well, it's shocking, because of the gardening and stuff. We have, over the years, been in places where they've been building houses, and they're basically made out of sort of balsa wood and steel hangers. There's no form of natural heating in there at all. If the oil dries up, you'll be in all sorts of trouble. And quite a lot of them, things like the roofs leak and stuff like that. They don't look nice, and they're no good either. And they're really expensive too.
Mm.
So, I mean, one of the things I know we wanted to talk about in this, because we've touched on loads of kind of aspects of the illusion and the different levels that it's running at. But it's becoming apparent as time goes by that some of the bigger things we think about are illusion. And I mean, history you've referred to, I think we're all experiencing the fact that it isn't necessarily quite like what we've been told it is. And you sent me a very interesting link, which was called The Man Who Swam. I'll just get it up because I'll put it in the chat box. It's a YouTube link, and it's called The Man Who Swam in Nuclear Cooling Pools Says Radiation Is Not Dangerous. Do you want to give us a bit of a homeopathic summary on that one?
Well, I could do. I'll ramble again. We use all the radiant remedies. We use uranium nitrate, and we use strontium carbonate, and baryta carbonate and barium carbonate, quite a lot of things. They're all incredibly good and very, very profound remedies for us. But one of the things I have been speculating about myself is I met somebody many years ago who was exploring where uranium was mined from. And what he discovered, and he died very shortly after in a most suspicious circumstance, he discovered that all uranium mines, without exception, in his understanding, was mined from sacred sites. And I'd never forgotten that. And suddenly,
that is interesting.
Isn't it? Mm. And then I thought, you know, radiation, all black, all powerful, all destructive, all horrible, all violent, all dangerous. That sounds a bit like a projection to me. You know, nothing is that bad. And then I thought, I looked at the films about Chernobyl and how the wildlife is flourishing there. And not all the daisies have three heads. And then we got some of the children from Chernobyl over to where I live. There's a bunch of about, there's probably about 40 altogether over 3 or 4 years. They came over every year and they stayed with local people, and we fed them and we treated them homeopathically. But you know, they had a little bit of thyroid problems, about half of them. Many of them had tooth problems, dental problems, and they were undernourished because they were so poor. But they weren't monsters. They were all born after Chernobyl. And so I started thinking more and more. And then I thought, well, radiance actually is another word, isn't it?
We get radiation from a radiator. That's why they're called radiators.
That's right. But the other term is radiance, and that's what Jesus has at the back of his head. And I thought about this, and I thought about uranium being mined from sacred sites. And this is my crackpot theory, okay? The baby boomers were the first generation to be exposed in large amounts to, you know, Hiroshima and Bikini and test sites and stuff. And it is that generation that discovered psychotherapy and meditation and trying to break the links, the time-honoured links in their families of bad habits and bad emotional practices. and are discovering more and more spirituality. And I just have this lovely thought that instead of being frightened of it, why don't we visualize it as something that is radiating us, making us more spiritually awake?
Interestingly, that also, because I mean, I remember when I was a lad how dull and relatively limited the diet was in this country, and now of course it's absolutely massive, and if we are what we eat, then that also was a pretty significant change to be experiencing.
Yes. Well, I think we're undergoing enormous changes without really being aware of it. You know, the saddest thing to me is it actually linked to food, which is not connected to radiation though, is that we've lost the capacity that animals have, that they are part of their environment because they eat it.
I try
to eat out of my garden so that the bugs in my gut are the same as the bugs in the garden, and then you can't get ill.
Yep, and it's true, isn't it, that that honey that's gathered by bees that are local to us and juice that's made out of apples that are local to us are all miles better than stuff that comes from a long way away.
Yes, absolutely. But with the radiation thing, I mean, I do hope your listeners or some of them will go and have a look at this video because it's fascinating. There's one that follows it as well if you just let it run.
Yep.
And they both talk about how until it was legislated for being so very toxic, nobody thought of it as toxic. Marie Curie certainly didn't.
And the guy that made the vid, so you see him doing a presentation and then there's an interview with him, he actually was responsible for designing doing the specs for and building nuclear containment plants, so he really does know what he's talking about. And he said they were happily wandering around with the best part of 2.5 kilos of this apparently radioactive stuff just in their lab coat pockets, wasn't he?
That's right, and he actually takes some out of his pocket and shows you it and says, you know, the whole of this county ought to be evicted and made to move out because it's all so dangerous. But, you know, this little bit of uranium in my pocket, this is really, really dangerous.
And he just
wipes it off his hands and say, right, I've decontaminated myself.
And he says it's heat, doesn't he? And that basically he could swim. He was literally swimming in the cooling pools for this building, this nuclear building that he'd made. And that the only thing that stopped him doing that was a bunch of guys in suits started turning up and laying all sorts of restrictions on what they could and couldn't do.
Mm. So you have this problem again of what is hearsay evidence. Mm. Why I liked that video was it was a man who was talking. It's hearsay to me and to you, but to him it's direct evidence. It's his experience, and it contradicts what we've been told to believe. And it's a bit like this crazy argument that's going on my Facebook feed anyway about the flat earth.
Oh God.
You know, and it's brilliant, Ben, because what's happening is it's helping you to think, how do you know anything is true? The amount of disinformation I think is doing us a strange sideways sort of good service. Because it's making us think twice about anything anyone tells us that we don't directly know and trust. And that might be a good thing. Might be about time we had what used to be called a reality check.
Yes, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And certainly people are forced to think about things by the flat earth stuff. But there's... I think the problem is there seem to be a lot of people who aren't necessarily thinking about it. Because there's several convincing arguments, actually, in all of those vids. I've watched a lot of them. And I can see how people are thinking that they might be credible. But it's such a difficult one, that is. But I can see your point. I can see your point that somebody's...
All it means is that you have to think for yourself and... In a way, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. But if we're being fed stories, like about life is always progressive onwards and upwards and improving, I simply don't believe that anymore. I haven't believed it for a very long time. You know, the incapacity for having clean air and clean water and clean food.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that medieval life was perfect, but there were certainly different things. I mean, just looking around you, your senses are so battered by noise. Your eyes are so battered by bright, garish colours. You know, children are given all these hugely coloured plastic toys. And I like the Steiner approach that says, actually, children don't need lots of stimulation. Give them wooden toys. That's the right colour.
Mm.
You know, we're overstimulated with new and new and new, all sorts of ideas and throwaway ideas. And it used to be thought this, but now we know. Well, do you? Do you know? I don't think you do. Do you know the difference between a theory and a fact? No, I don't think so. And I come back to my five senses and the people whose testimony I trust.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to think my way through everything I see and hear and say yes, no, or I don't know about it. And I don't know is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, this is exactly what Christy Oji was talking about. He was talking about receiving the world and acting on it as we feel it in our bodies.
Yes.
Not as we think about it.
Yes.
I remember looking recently and discovering that the difference between knowledge and belief is simply a question of a degree of certainty. So we can't be sure about anything. And funnily enough, it has been, Synchro and I recently have been kind of reviewing the various projects that we're involved in and have decided that the best thing we can do is to actually work with the communities that we're already working with and concentrate on them and be amongst them, because they are the only thing that's real to us. And they're the only place where we can realistically expect to make any difference, because, you know, people know us and trust us and we've worked with them for years. Where else are we going to put our effort in any more effectively than just there?
Well, I think that's where we come to what you and I were discussing earlier. What can you do? And I spent some years wondering if I ought to go and woman the barricades. And I've concluded, actually, the best thing I can do is do what I do already, which is helping all the people I can within reach, and using my homeopathy and just being myself.
Yeah.
Because if you are yourself, then other people feel you're like oak. You're something solid they can lean up against. Go away feeling stronger.
And the cosmos does have a way of giving you challenges that you can deal with, giving you challenges that are actually perfectly crafted for your skills, although maybe close to the edge of where your toolbox might take you.
Can I quote you a bit of Goethe?
Yes, please do, and then we'll have a bit of music and come back with some solutions. Let's have some Goethe.
Okay, it's something I'm dearly fond of, this. It says, whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and endless plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would otherwise never have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed could have come his way. So whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it. Begin it now.
I'd heard the last couple of sentences. I'd never heard the run-up to that before. And that, of course, is exactly what we're planning on talking about, is how intent and decision changes the way the world works for us. And until you do it and see these little subtle changes in your life, and like Goethe was describing, a kind of flow of meetings and occurrences that just seem to be kind of washing you onto your aim, that kind of change occurs, and until you actually decide to make changes in your life, you don't actually get to experience that. It's probably happening, but you're so distracted that you don't notice it.
Mm. But also the universe gives you what you want. If you want to be helpless and ineffectual, then that's what you'll be. I have this idea that I call the cosmic notice board, and we're pinning things up on it all the time. So if you pin up that you want to meet somebody who will be your companion in going off and doing this battle or you know, setting up this newspaper or something, that person will arrive. They will arrive, and they do.
Just at the right moment as well, quite often.
Yes, and you just fall over them, but it probably isn't exactly how you expected it. You know, you may think that you need lots of money to do it, so you're hoping to meet someone who's got lots of money, and what you find instead is somebody who makes you laugh a lot, and you just put it together with sellotape and bits of string instead because you're so happy. But it works, and I live my life on this basis. The cosmic notice board is really, really brilliant for me. And I think the universe just gives you what you've decided you want.
Yes, and like Joe Campbell says, it all works so much better if you follow your heart.
Yes.
He says that basically if you do that, then doors will open for you. Not only will doors open for you that wouldn't have opened otherwise, but doors will open for you that just wouldn't be there for other people. And that's why we're living not in one world, but in 7,000 million different worlds. One planet.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
Nicely put.
Well, we've come to about halfway through the show. It's kind of coming up to 10 o'clock. It's just gone 10 o'clock. So I'm going to put on a bit of tunage so we can have a wee break. I'm talking to Stella Berg, and we've been talking about fear and illusion. And we're going to be moving on to talk about responsibility and courage, because they just changed the world. And coming up, about eight minutes of music, I think. Oh, hang on, that's better. Something's gone weird in my headphones, sorry. Yeah, coming up, David Rovick. We'll have, making a few musical side references to the selection in America. And this is another one of those references. It's by a chap called David Rovick, who's been imagining what it'd be like to get a president who does the kind of stuff that we'd like to see him do. And it's called If Only It Were True. Oh, yes, if only it were true.
I turned on my TV, though it was hard to see these men who would be head of state. What a great country, from sea to shining sea, we watched the Republicans debate. Newt stood with his third wife and said, "You bet your life, the president is a red. He wants to tax the gay."
You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com and autonomousmedia.net. And this evening I'm talking with Stella Berg. Hiya, Stella. Oh, hang on a moment. I've forgotten to press the green button. There we go. There we go. If I say hi, Stella, now it'll work for you. Hi, Stella.
Hello, Ben.
That was the and Armageddon days are here again. As they pointed out, if the real Jesus Christ were to arrive today, he'd get shot down dead by the CIA. Do you think we've forgotten the message and are worshipping the creed?
I think the powers that be are certainly trying to get us that way. But it's hard to kill that in humans.
Well, this is one of the things that's happening, isn't it? Is that basically we have drives that we know that we need to satisfy and stuff, and those drives are now being really pretty comprehensively frustrated. The problems or the challenges as outlined in the kind of first half of the show appear to be pretty massive, but I think we agree, don't we, that the solutions are basically pretty simple. What do you think is the most important thing we need to realise in this messy old Armageddon days?
I think fundamentally that people are kind and generous and less frightened. Most people are good people. And, you know, now and then I hear someone sounding off about, you know, everybody's so mean these days. Actually, you know, I do this thing called a love offensive. It's like a charm offensive. I just treat everybody as if I love them. And the funny thing is, within 5 minutes, I generally do. And they respond so lovingly back. And this is normal, surely.
Well, that thing you put your finger on, actually one of the, what I think is one of the most important things there, is that a lot of the stuff that we get back from other people is stuff that we've inadvertently perhaps put out there in the first place.
Yes. We're all mirrors for each other all the time. I mean, don't you find when you're in a good mood, people are kinder to you?
Yes, it's absolutely right. The way I approach people completely determines really the way they're going to approach me. And it's why if I am having a difficult time, I prefer not to be amongst people until I've sorted it out.
Well, there's that, or there's something I've learned as I'm getting old now, which I have to say is great fun, much more fun than I thought it would be. And I'm realising I can't do everything by myself, and I have to ask people. And, you know, it's been a revelation to me how much people love to be of help and how kind other people are to me when I'm not okay. And I think either I'd forgotten it or I'd never known it, but our culture doesn't encourage us to go and ask our friends and neighbours, please, can you do this? And it's lovely. I've made much deeper friendships, I think, being older and being less independent.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And I when people are helping you or whatever, you are effectively working together. And I find that the working with people is the best way of getting to know them.
Yes, because they're not acting, they're doing.
Yes, and you're getting to know what each other are capable of in all sorts of ways. I think there's all manner of communication that goes on when we're performing tasks together, which just doesn't go on if you're just, I don't know, sitting drinking tea or not talking to anybody.
I wonder if there's something to be looked at, the difference between acting and being and doing.
Yeah.
Acting is almost false in a way. Being isn't and doing isn't. And yet action should be like a water bursting through a dam. You know, this thing you've made your mind up, you go and do something and you do it with energy. That's acting in one way. But in another way, you've got acting as in presenting a false self. And I think we conflate the two and it's quite important not to.
Yes, that I think is somewhat tied into actually being yourself in all circumstances, because almost by definition, if you're a different individual, as I was describing I was, in different circumstances, somewhere in amongst it is the real you, and the rest of it are facsimiles or masks, basically, that you're putting on to get away with it, I think.
Could be. Or it could be this mirroring. If do you think it might be about feeling powerless? That, you know, if you are needing to make somebody like you, then you mirror them. You take on their accent or you behave in certain ways because you need their approval. And if you feel powerful, then you can be yourself. But then if you're arrogant, you do it all the time in other people's faces. It's all balance, isn't it?
Yes.
It's all fun to get it right. And I think you can't get it right by being intellectual about it. You have to go back to the heart.
Yes, because what you're doing is going to be different depending on who you're dealing with and what sort of state they're in and stuff. It is a real in-the-moment thing, which, as Chris was saying, relies on you paying attention to your emotions rather than ignoring them, and seeing what is real inside your body rather than what you've been told is real. And the only way you can experience that is by experiencing other people.
Yes, and listening carefully. And if there's a great row of shouty voices going on inside you, you can't hear anybody outside.
Yes, that's absolutely true. At the same time, sometimes, I mean, I think that it's a point that we're encouraged to speak when we're calmer rather than when we're actually feeling what we're feeling. And sometimes it's necessary to deal with things like that in the moment. But by addressing the thing rather than by attacking the individual.
Mm. One of the things I'm my background makes me clear about is one the idea of righteous anger. I don't feel it very often, but when I do, my goodness, the moral force of it. You know, I had occasion to tell a young man a few weeks ago. He'd behaved extremely badly. Basically, he'd been really ill, and he'd come over to me on a Sunday to be sorted out. And he had got sorted out, but he neither thanked me nor did he do. You know, he didn't acknowledge it in any way. He just walked off better. And weeks later, he rang me up to ask me to say he was sorry, and I think wanted to come and see me again. And I expressed my righteous anger, and he was really, really blown over by it. Mm. And I think, in a way, it's like parenting. We're not encouraged to be authoritative parents. Now, it's not the same as harsh parents. It's just knowing you're the grown-up and the other person is the child.
And there's a difficult distinction to make, isn't it? Because that you described really brilliantly there, I think, what I was trying to get at. By and large, my impression is that being angry and shouting at people never really helps. But it does seem to me now in my maturity that there are occasions when it is necessary to be really quite stern. I still don't think it helps to shout and insult people, but it is necessary sometimes to, as you said, to express your anger. And when you get it right, it works better than anything else.
Yes. Yes, it does. It's very shocking.
Is there any way we can start maybe describing how it is you determine when it is that you need to talk like that and when it is you need to hold your peace and maybe deal with it in a different forum? Because that's what it boils down to. Hard choice to make or describe, I think.
Oh, Solomon would know, wouldn't he?
So they say.
I don't know. I mean, I've spent a lifetime doing it wrong, of course, as we all have. But sometimes these days, as I get older, I can do it from a peaceful place where I know somebody needs to be taken in hand a little bit. And it's not acting out. It's not acting from your own personal hurt. It's just saying this is not acceptable. And it's a shock to people because it's forceful. But, you know, if people your age and my age are not able to be authoritative when we need to, then we can't. I've discovered that my feeling is that the grandparents' generation are the arbiters of moral standards.
Yeah, that's the way it goes for sure.
Yeah, parents discipline, but the grandparents tell you why you mustn't do this because they have the time. And again, it's one reason that relationship is being systematically severed. Because if a granny or a grandpa tells you, you really mustn't do that, that's not the right thing for people to do. Children and even young adults and older people will listen because it's got a depth and a resonance of authenticity that is very convincing and very moving.
Mm. I have a feeling there's something going on there where offspring quite often turn out to be like a mirror of the parent, if you like, rather than like a reflection of them, so kind of all opposed in the mirror. And because that's the way it goes, offspring are more likely to be in tune with their grandparents than they are with their own parents on some levels. So there's a kind of identification there as well as an authority.
Do you know, I can remember many years ago when I was a social worker, there was a mess up in the holiday system so that accidentally the teenage delinquents were sent on holiday with the old age pensioners. And everybody was tearing their hair out in our department because it was such a mess up. But you know what? You found all these naughty teenagers pushing the elderly about, confessing all their lives. And the old people were listening with fascination and kindness and saying, yes, it was a bit like that in the 20s. I really liked cocaine myself. So they got all right, houses on fire, and there was no trouble. And you know, they never did it again.
No, you don't want to repeat things that work well.
No.
Because the same thing happened. This community land trust that we're getting involved in used to be a small holding project. And the idea was that they had one or two staff. They had a whole load of volunteers, and the local social services were using it as a place to put the differently enabled, and everybody ended up helping everybody else. And in the end, inspectors came round and couldn't tell the difference between the staff, the volunteers and the clients. And this was a problem for them. And at that point, they set about limiting the funding in such a way that the place could no longer function. But what I'd say about that is that these things that we're talking about are demonstrations that the drive for us as men and women to still do things like that are still amongst us. All we need to do is shift our notions of authority to where it truly lies, which is with us and what we do. You know, if changing our own behaviour is the only and the best thing we can do, then we are the ones that are in charge, and we can see that we can do things better too.
I think that's absolutely right. And not only that, but one source of optimism is that all we have to do is things that come naturally. What's happened is we've been changed from what we are into this mould. And it's the most natural thing in the world to go back to being like children in kindergartens. You know, they have their rages, they have their bad sides, but fundamentally, as soon as they get to three or so, they're happy to cooperate a lot of the time. And that's the human default setting, is we are tribal creatures.
And I guess one of the things about actually getting in touch with your own world and things is that the first things you're likely to address are going to be the way you feed yourself, and possibly, you know, any medicines, any kind of things you might need outside the food to help you out. And those kind of things are naturally taking you back to the kind of grounding that we were talking about earlier in the show, because they're all old, known things.
Yes. Tradition and familiarity and trust.
Yeah, and they're things that you can learn about yourself as well, I think, which is a point you made last time we spoke, is that one of the things about homeopathy is that because of the constitutional types and because of the disease families and stuff, nobody has to understand, apart from the homeopath, has to understand the whole thing. Individuals can actually quite easily learn to manage their own small range of remedies, can't they? It's actually familiar to them, then again, taking responsibility for their own health.
Yes. And when someone has taken the step to go and see an alternative therapist or of any sort who is good, I think it becomes a partnership. You know, the person knows about their health and the practitioner knows about what to do about it, and they swap information. So they're helping each other. One isn't better than the other.
I think a good homeopath has little choice, really, but to learn from the cases that are presenting themselves to her or him.
Well, that's right. And also, you know, I teach as many people as I can get hold of, because it's easier for me. I can't deal with all the acute problems of every single patient. So if I teach them to deal with their acute problems and I deal with the constitutional ones that require the expertise, everybody's happy. And I can treat more people on the deep level. But what's always filled me with admiration is how much people take it, hold it in their hands like something precious, and take it away and learn and understand. And once you set people off in the right direction, they're self-managing. You know, it's remembering, it's putting back together.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, of course, one of the most important things of homeopathy, and not just homeopathy, but I'm aware that a lot of the talking therapies are said to work really well with things like depression and stuff like that. And it's because, I suspect that it's because the focus is being put back on the self.
Yes, and having a witness, I think, very important.
Yeah, again, that business of being able to talk to somebody else about it.
Someone who doesn't condemn.
And
here, back at what should we do? Well, I think one of the first things is to learn to confront one's own fear and shame and guilt. Because whatever you do, people are always doing their best. Always, always doing their best. And the trouble is they feel it's not a very good best.
And part of our job there, I think, is for us to feed back and let people know when we think they really have done their best.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's very easy. I think there's a lot of criticism goes out in this world, and very rarely do people necessarily get the feedback that supports them.
Well, do you know, one of my favourite words talking about this is encouragement. It means to put heart into, or just as enthusiasm means to put God into, to entheos people.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have it all in the words. Chris Deirdre is right. It's all in the words.
Yeah, the solutions and many of the challenges, I think, are in the words. And what do you think about, we were talking a bit earlier on about kind of ways of organising things, because we've got so used to top-down authority that we almost automatically kind of cede all of our responsibilities to somebody else. What we're effectively talking about here is we're kind of imagining that community will arise from people working with each other, from people finding new ways of doing things. And you mentioned that you were part of an online farmers market. I hadn't heard about that. What was that?
Oh, that's fun. We had a bunch of land rights activists who took over an empty farm. And they started it. They started the idea that they would sell local food grown by local people. And instead of just having all customers, anybody who had an overdose of rhubarb in the garden or a tree full of apples could put their spare food up. So we're all customers and we're all producers. And it's done online, and we do buy in a little bit, but from as locally as possible. And you know, it saved £30,000 in this locality last year. That it stayed in the area. It didn't go out to supermarkets.
That's because one of,
every pound you spend in a supermarket, I'm not sure if I've got it right, but I think it's 82p flies far away. Whereas if you buy things in our area, then nearly all the money stays in the area. And we save £30,000. And it's tiny, but it's growing.
Yes, that occurred to us about the apple juice we've made. Even if we give it away to everybody, that's money that is not going into Mr. Aldi's pocket.
Yes, that's right. So do you have lots and lots of apples then?
Yes. Yeah, we've got access to as many apples as we want, really. So we pasteurised about 900 bottles this year. But we've also made quite a lot of cider, and we're going to be making live apple cider vinegar this year too. So we're kind of branching out. But the apple juice is just so gorgeous that for years I wouldn't make cider out of it, because the juice itself is so great. And the thing I like about it is that they're kind of lying around on the ground, and even if they're up the tree, they're easy to get at. And it really... the amount of work that went into making those 900 bottles wasn't particularly significant, in my opinion. I think it probably took us about 7 days in total to gather all the apples, pulp them all, pasteurise them. And now we've got a bottle a day every day, and we've got loads of apples that we can either trade or give away with other people. And it's a great point of contact. I think if you're growing herbs, or if you're making apple juice, or if you're doing anything that can be used as a means of bartering with your own community rather than actually having to force people to pay you for things, then the relationship goes far beyond the thing you've made. There is suddenly communication on a level that wouldn't have been there before. And I think that that's one of the biggest advantages, is that it's an opportunity to open conversation and start dealing with people that you maybe haven't had the opportunity to deal with before. And they themselves will present you with new challenges and new learnings.
Do you know, I think you've hit a really big button there, because it seems to me that a lot of things would be solved if we started not dealing in money so much, but dealing in swapping needed services.
Yes, well, we're thinking of trying to experiment with that idea. We'd actually like to have a market stall, because we now know lots of people who are making lots of things. We could have a really varied stall. We could stand behind it and play Baroque recorded duets and things like that. But what we want to do is have like a pound value on things. So the apple juice is like, as a separate bottle, say it's £2.50. You'd give it a standard exchange equivalent of 250. And when people come along and say, well, I want a bottle of apple juice, you can say, well, we'd rather not take coin of the realm. We'd like to barter. So what do you do? And so again, what you'd be doing, maybe they'd end up giving you the 250 pennies anyway, but there'd have been a conversation that again is going to encourage community and cooperation and all that kind of stuff. I think we'll probably actually do that. It'd be if they'll let us have a market stall and try to give everything away or swap it rather than, you know, sell it. Mm. And in the process, we can also tell people about the nature of cash and how it ideally should never go back in the bank. That if cash is going to be used, it should be used amongst us and kept there where it works hardest.
Well, if I have it right, something like 70% of what a person in a standard job earns goes out in national insurance and tax and VAT and, of course, petrol charges on everything you buy anywhere. So, you know, you're left with 30% of what you earned. That's terrible. Whereas if you swap something with something, you get 100% of its value.
And in my experience, you quite often get more. You quite often get a better exchange rate actually dealing in stuff than you do dealing in the money, which, you know, you've got to represent, may have a representative value on it. But quite often, it works a lot better than money.
Yes, I think so. We have several institutions around us, which I think they're nationwide. But if your listeners don't know about them, one is called Street Bank, and that puts people in touch with each other in a certain area, you know, either 5 or 10 or 15 miles away from each other. So you can get to know all the other people who sign up on Street Bank. And the idea is you give away things or skills, or you loan things, or you teach things, and you make offers. And I think Street Bank is fun. Did you know about that one?
No, that's a new one on me. I'm just taking a note.
And there's Local Let, that's the local exchange trading systems, which is where you have the local, like Manchester has Bobbins, for example. And it's the local currency. Bristol has just invented a Bristol pound that does that.
Yeah, I'd really like to go and talk to people who are using some of these experimental currencies. We lived for a while around Stroud, and they've got the Stroud Groat, I think. And it was pretty successful.
Yeah. Well, I think they're growing. One of the problems I found, I've belonged to several lets in my time, is you don't get very many working people, working men, as it's called, you know, plumbers and carpenters and electricians. You get an awful lot of cake makers and computer people. And, you know, offering medical services, I've always ended up with thousands of lets and nothing much to spend them on. But it's a baby system. It's very new and it's growing.
And again, I mean, the people who aren't getting involved, the electricians and the plumbers, they're amongst the ones who are most under the hammer because I know electricians and plumbers, and they're constantly being required to do this continuous professional development, which means they're constantly having to pay to do more courses, to get further qualified. They have to charge a whole shed load of money for their time as a result. And actually, because we live where we live, we still have people who are doing that sort of trade, but are actually kind of happy to barter to a certain extent as well. And I remember because of certain bartering advantages we had at the time, shall I say, I remember phoning a plumber because we had a leak in the kitchen and it was spraying water everywhere. And, he said, yeah, okay, I'll be round. I said, okay, I'll put the kettle on. And he was with us by the time the kettle boiled. He was really keen to come and work for us.
How nice.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing is, this is part of what's needed, is for people to start disobeying the petty micromanagement of our lives a bit. You know, you shouldn't need to register everything, because in common law, when you register something, you give it away. So if I want to sell something on the food hub that I've made, like my falafels, for example, I'm encouraged to register my kitchen with the local council. And that means they have a right of entry to my house any time, day or night. I don't see why they should do that. So my stand has been, well, I want to sell this food, and any of my neighbours can come over and have a cup of tea and have a look at my kitchen, see if they think it's clean enough. Why do I need to involve the council in this?
It's private.
It's private. And I think electricians and plumbers and people need to start saying, well, no, I have the qualifications I want for what I'm doing. And if I need to know any new things, I will ask someone to teach me. But I'm not going to do any more Section 4 and, you know... It's a form of bullying, isn't it?
It is, and basically it ensures that only the compliant and the solvent actually can keep doing it, whether they know what they're doing or not.
Yes. I mean, if I wanted to get an electric point moved, presumably I'd have to call in a qualified electrician. It cost me upwards of £40. That's ridiculous.
I think you can get anybody to do it, but you've got to get a qualified electrician to come and have a look at it and sign it off, I think. Turnips put in the chat box that Let's got shut down years ago.
Not ours. Ours works.
No, I think there was an attempt to get a national Let's system going. There are several still running around the country, but I think it's uncoordinate.
Yes. Well, the thing is, these are all little bubbles rising to the surface, aren't they? And I think they should all be encouraged. Some will survive and some won't. But we have a Let's, and we also have Just for the Love of It, which is where you roll up and you just do things for people. And that might have died, but it was a lovely idea.
And it was a good experiment that some people will remember and will carry forward one way or the other, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I think we are at a point where so many people are frustrated with the money system. They are looking for active alternatives.
Well, let's face it, if you're having 80% or whatever, because 80% is the estimate I've heard, between 65 and 80% of your income being removed, it means that if you were to successfully adjust your way to other ways of making your living, well, I mean, let's put it this way, at the moment you're working from, say, January through to halfway through to September for the government, and you're living off the rest. So anything you can do to reduce that unfair advantage has got to help you out, and it seems to me that it does.
Yes, I think it does. You retain all that you have worked for. And in fact, if I may put in a little plug at this point, anyone who's interested in the money system could look into the Bradbury Pound, which the UK column is pushing, which is money issued by the government, which is interest-free. And that will get us out of the hands of the bankers and the odious debt they've put us in.
Well, it was it did used to be the way of doing it. And I had this was another of my illusion realisations of actually grokking what was going on. I was listening to a discussion, a parliamentary debate, where Michael Meacher was talking about money creation. And apparently it's the first debate they've had on the subject for 160 years. And what came out in that was the fact that as I knew this, that the Bank Charter Act actually limited the amount of money that banks can create as a result of money cash that's being borrowed off them. Okay, so it put limits on how far fractional reserve banking could go, how much money you could make out of £100 loan, and those limits were pretty huge. But what Meacher says in this debate, he says some words along to the effect of, some of us are thinking that maybe we should be considering putting similar controls on digital money, which can only mean there are no controls on the creation of digital money, which explains entirely where all the debts come from. And having your government print the money without interest would sort that. Like Simon Spaniard says, if we did that, we'd have to work 2.5 weeks a month less.
If not more.
If not more.
Or less, rather.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this whole idea of money that is intangible, money doesn't exist. there is no such thing as money. It's only an idea. And it's an idea that's gone very much against our interests.
Yes, yeah. And this is one of the things that really does my head in, because effectively, as I never tire of saying, you go down the co-op, you load 100 quid's worth of tackle into your trolley, you hand over a promise to pay and you leave. So effectively, nobody's ever being paid for anything. The money's completely imaginary, which surely means we could just do without it. It's very difficult to understand how it's come to be the way it is.
Yes. Well, you know, I think its time is coming. More and more people are beginning to understand that money is a prison for us. You know, what I'd like to see, this new round of evictions that's going to happen because of all the benefit caps, I would like to see people being encouraged to help their neighbours. Just say, no, I'm not leaving my house. This is my home. Have you heard of the response teams?
I have heard of the response teams. They seem to be doing a pretty good job by all accounts.
Well, they're encouraging people simply not to give in and have their houses taken away for the sake of an imaginary debt. You know,
there's so many ways of defending your position at the moment.
Yes, but solidarity is one of it.
I think numbers really count. We know that they can't actually properly throw you out of your house unless you actually leave. And we also know that there's things like the official offer and stuff, which make it pretty impossible for anybody to throw you out of your house until the capital becomes due, the capital sum. And we know also that there are now quite substantially good methods for reducing the capital sum over that time as well. So I think that's a really good place for people to be concentrating, plus the fact that what you really need in life is a roof over your head. If you haven't got that, then you really are stuffed. And I know, because we tried. Interesting point from Ken in the chat box says the Bradbury pound was used to get rid of the gold standard. Not a good example, he says. It got the banks where they wanted to be. I think that's a fair point, but the point is that whether we use the Bradbury name or not, what we need is a currency that is issued by the government without interest.
Or by communities for their own use.
Oh, well, that'd be even better, I think.
Yes. I think the whole thing goes back to the frightening and the unreality that we were talking about earlier. My feeling is if an animal can see and touch and understand it, then it exists. And if it can't, then you need to question it. So an animal doesn't know what a pound is. It knows what an apple is. But, you know, the money doesn't really have that reality, whereas a handshake and a thank you for doing that and what can I do for you, that's real. But a bit of paper? Not so sure about that.
And it builds up what, I mean, we call it social capital. You know, the fact that people are constantly wandering around doing things for each other and stuff. It gives you credential beyond money. And in fact, that also is something that's enhanced when you start going around helping people out. The very fact that you're not asking for money can lead to all sorts of things that wouldn't have otherwise arisen. It's a very strange thing, the money. And I think it's important to bear in mind that the money doesn't matter a toss to the people with the money machines. What matters to the people with the money machines is that money stays important to us. So clearly one of the things we can usefully do is make it slowly but surely less important, just a bit at a time.
I think that's beautifully put. Really do. Yes, they want it to matter to us and we need to stop it being like that. But that involves trusting one another. So we're back to getting to know your neighbours and helping in the community, aren't we?
And, I mean, you know, as we come to the end of the talky bit of the show, because I'll probably play some tunes afterwards, I normally do nowadays, that's basically what it boils down to, is that talking with people, working with people, trading with people, completely, and following our own intent in those processes, completely changes the way our individual lives work along the lines of, as described by your reading from Goethe earlier on. And whatever it is that we're heading for, whatever changes it is that we're going to see, and I think everybody agrees there's going to be a lot of big ones, then these sort of things we're talking about are, in any event, exactly the kind of behaviours that that are going to help us under those circumstances, I would have thought.
Yes, I think so. And one last thing I'd like to say is, being a person who's into words, we have lost some very important words from our everyday vocabulary, quite deliberately. We've lost words like loving kindness and faith and hope. We just don't use them very much. And loyalty and bravery. We need to have them back, because people are brave and kind and loyal and generous.
And I think it's important to bear in mind that you can only be brave when you're frightened.
Yes. So yes, turn to your neighbour for help and you'll get the support. And then love grows from that.
Yes.
We do know all these things. We just need to remember them.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, it all boils down to just doing things slightly differently.
Yes. Yes, I think giving without counting astonishingly works much better than keeping a bill all the time, keeping a tab going.
Yes, it does, because quite often the payback can come back from somewhere completely different. I think they call it, paying it on or some paying it down? Can't remember. Anyway, the idea that you do something not expecting anything back, and one way or the other you will get something back.
Yes, I think that's always the case, really. You know, we just need to be like children. We learned it all before we were five.
Yes, yeah, indeed, and then slowly but surely had it convinced out of us. But again, to go back to the basic point, which is that the harder the apparent authority squeezes, the more people are going to start doing something different. Pay it forward. Thanks, Nick, that's the one.
And the British do have a very good reputation, actually, for doing fantastically well under hard conditions.
Again, I think that there's certain cause to think that that we do a lot better when we're under pressure.
Yes.
Which is just as well, given the kind of pressure we're being put under.
Do you know, I feel very optimistic. I feel humans are coming back to their proper selves. I like to think I'm seeing it more around me. And I have a great deal of faith that this time of living rather mechanical, obedient slave lives, it's beginning to shatter. And inside, warm, kindly, smiley people are coming out. It sounds absurd to say it in this situation, but I have a sense that we so long to belong and have community and have security and trust. I think we're going to build it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because I see it arising in all sorts of places where it is allowed to arise, like in festival crews and various local community groups and stuff, where people are working with each other and community is arising. And as I was saying to you earlier on, having read Frederick Laloux's book, Reinventing Organisations, I'm aware that there are new ways of managing huge systems just evolving from amongst people. So I think we can actually see it happening, not only on our own scale, you know, locally with the people that we deal with every day, but I think we can start seeing signs of it on a much larger scale. So the best thing we can do is keep doing what we're doing.
Yes, I think we have reason to hope.
Well, that's brilliant, Stella. I think we have reason to hope. That's a really great place to leave it, don't you think?
Yes. Thank you so much, Ben. That has been a really lovely conversation with you.
Well, I enjoyed that, and thanks very much for coming along. And hopefully, as I say, hopefully you'll be back in a few weeks, and we've got one or two other subjects that we'd like to cover, wouldn't we?
I think I'd enjoy that very much.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for being with us. I'm going to play a couple of tunes now, after which I'll come back for a bit, and then I'll probably play some tunes up to midnight. But I'm going to, as I say goodbye to Stella, I'm going to play Feral Primate by Smiling Ivy. And I'll be back with you in a few minutes.